It's a great privilege to be here. Thank you. I feel humbled because I have no knowledge or experience in dementia care except personal family circumstances. So I come here to give you some thoughts from my own research and the research of other people about the context, the scientific context of the critically important work that you're doing. And I have to say, particularly in terms of the Genio-funded pilot projects, which I've found out quite a bit about recently, and I think they're really outstanding. And I think what I'm going to talk about today really is about the brain and environment, how the environments that are created for people shape the physiology and biochemistry of the brain, probably more strongly than any drug that currently exists for, certainly any drug that currently exists for the treatment of dementia. So this is critically important, what you do, the care of dementia and the activities and environments that people live in the onset before the dementia comes on, which is obviously critically important for prevention. So that's what I'm going to be talking a bit about, there we go, excellent. There we go. So now, forgive me, those of you that have been to one of my talks where I use this example. But this example actually is very, very important, I think, for the theme of the talk, and strangely enough, for dementia care. So this is the cichlid fish of Lake Tanganyika, and these are both males. And the males come in two forms. The NT is the top, and the T at the bottom. Now, Mr. NT is dowdily colored, submissive, sexually infertile, unaggressive, and generally has a tough time in life, compared to Mr. T-fish, who's a swaggering, muscular, multicolored buccaneer of a fish who spends his life dominating the poor old NT and the females around them. And you might think here is evolution doing its job. However, sometimes something very strange happens. Sometimes, over the course of 24 hours to 7 days, Mr. NT turns into Mr. T in every respect: coloring, size, sexual fertility, aggressiveness, dominance. So the mystery is, why does this happen? I'll come back to that at the end of this talk. there we go. So I want to talk now about, here we have an environment, here we have a multi-street in Naples, wonderful cross-section street of Naples. And I want to think about, you know, you're dealing with people with dementia, and many of you are dealing with people who will get dementia, who are maybe starting to slow down cognitively, worried about whether they're going to develop dementia. So we have to think, how do we understand this? Now, the major effort in terms of treating dementia has been at the molecular level, you know, the new drugs, molecular and cellular level, new drugs. We don't have any treatments for dementia, but we do have a few treatments, no new ones in the last 20 years that have small effects on the symptoms, but no treatments for dementia yet. A huge amount of, most of the research is focused on the molecular and cellular level. Rightly so, because we need to find ways at that level to alter it. But the usual, there's many, you can analyze a phenomenon like dementia or even human behavior in general at many levels, from the quantum through the molecular, cellular systems, cognitive, psychological, behavioral, to the social. And the usual assumption we make in science these days is that it goes in this direction, that the small things cause the big things. and this would be strongly influenced by our current genetic dominance of scientific discourse, that, a gene for this, a gene for that, and basically it's all pre-programmed, and science is about burrowing down to smaller and smaller levels. And this was captured by James Watson, the co-discoverer of DNA, who once said famously, "Everything is physics, all the rest is social work." So many levels to that statement, but I love saying to my molecular biology colleagues, you're essentially social workers, because the real business is in physics, which is, of course, a preposterous and absurd position. Because science is science, and science is not about how small the phenomenon you're dealing with. Science is about the method of underpinning, elucidating how things work, and the most exciting science is about how things work linking up these different levels of analysis. And a social process is every bit as real as a gene. A thought is every bit as real as a molecule. So I want to talk about cognitive reserve here, because it turns out that this is a very important phenomenon in the Alzheimer's disease, but also in the course of Alzheimer's disease once people have it. So here we have someone with an Alzheimer's brain on the right and a healthy brain on the left, and see the awful destruction of neurons that happens because of, as yet, not properly understood processes to do with Alzheimer's. But here we have an interesting finding, that is, if you have less than 8 years of education, you are 2.5 times more likely to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease later in life than if you have more than 8 years of education. And the normal kind of explanation that's given for this in the past has been, there's a common genetic basis that's causing both the education level, that is, people with a certain genetic profile are less bright and less likely to have education, that same gene is predisposing to a vulnerability to Alzheimer's disease. It's a very difficult argument to counter because most of these studies are correlational rather than causal. But here we have a Swedish study of twins, and only the Swedes could discover a group of identical twins who had dementia, and they could then look at their sibling. And then some of these siblings, and they could look at the levels of education these had in a cohort where genetics were equaled out because they were identical. Okay, so here we have the among the demented identical twin, that's the number of the cohort of 30 people who left school at the minimum legal age, which, depending on their age, could be 12, 14, 16. And here we have, for the non-demented identical twin, many fewer, 12 of them, left school at the minimum legal age. And what about stayed on in school? Only 7 of the demented identical twin, whereas 21 of the non-demented identical twin. So this gives strong support to the hypothesis that educational level is not just correlated with risk for dementia, but it has a causal link to it. Now, here we have, sorry, this kind of scrappy thing here, but I can tell you what it means. Group of German medical students, their brains are scanned 3 months before their final exams, at the time of their final exams, and then 3 months later. Bottom line is, there we go, bottom line is, their brains grew. The parietal cortex, which is the top, this part of the brain here, the gray matter expanded, probably because of connections between cells growing rather than new cells being generated. But even more interesting, the hippocampus, which is a critical memory center, the bit of the brain that's most affected in Alzheimer's, it's the bit that's to do with laying down new memories, that grew as well. And what's more, it continued growing for the 3 months after the exams, even when they stopped studying. So here's an example of how a social phenomenon, education, has biological effects on this very structure of the brain. So, and we know this now, this is Valenzuela and his colleagues, done postmortems on people with high and low cognitive reserve. And that is, cognitive reserve means IQ, education level, job complexity. Okay, that's the usual triad. So if you have had, you know, quite a number of years of education, if your IQ is above average, and if your job makes mental demands on you, if it's a complex job, then you will have high, that means you have high cognitive reserve. And when you compare people with high cognitive reserve, you do postmortems in their brains afterwards and compare them to people with low cognitive reserve, you find that their brains are actually thicker. And there are more brain cells per cubic centimeter in people with high cognitive reserve. So we're talking about something real here. We're talking about, you remember that graph I showed you about the social, we're talking about social endeavors, the artifacts of civilization, education, social organizations, civic organizations, we're talking about them shaping the biology of the brain. Now, this is a study where of what's called environmental enrichment. There are hundreds and hundreds of studies showing that if you put animals into an enriched environment where there's different things to engage, different pieces of stuff in their cages to engage with, and other animals to engage with, they show much better cognitive function than those that are kept in standard cages. And what's more, their brains actually grow new cells in response to that, and new connections in response to that enriched environment. But what's astonishing here is, this is a study comparing, these are actually of dogs who were kept in enriched environments versus standard environments and followed up until death. And they looked at their brains, not just at the brain structure, like they did in the German medical students, but about the amount of horrible amyloid plaque gunk in their brains, the kind of stuff that kills off cells in the people with Alzheimer's disease. And what you see here, those who were in the enriched environments had many fewer actual plaques of the disease in their brain. So here we have an intriguing possibility. Maybe it's not just the case that education and job complexity and IQ, maybe it's not just the case that they build a bigger, better connected brain that can better cope with the disease. Maybe also there's a possibility that these things might, in some ways, influence the very disease process itself. Now, so let's reconsider, go back to our Naples street, and realize that it's not doesn't just go small up to big. It goes the other way as well, that social level of analysis shapes the biology of the brain. The environments we live in, the things we do, the experiences we have, the interactions we have, alter the very expression of genes. What do I mean by expression of genes? It doesn't change the genes itself. The genes cannot be changed, but it switches genes on and off. The genes produce proteins, which are how they have their effect on the body. Environmental experiences and psychological experiences actually shape the functioning of genes and therefore their effects on our body. So the environments that you work in, the environments that you live in, shape the very biology of your brain right down to the molecular level. And so that's why I find the whole genial approach to dementia care so exciting and so innovative, is this notion that you're creating environments in order to maintain brain function. Of course, we really hope that our biological colleagues and medical colleagues will come on with molecular and cellular solutions that we can combine with these, but we can't do any of this at any one level of analysis. We need a truly comprehensive approach to this, and that's the aim of the Global Brain Health Institute, which Atlantic Philanthropies is so wonderfully funding, to train leaders who are going to be able to come in and become the advocates of this multidisciplinary approach and make it possible for us to, in scalable, policy-relevant ways, delay dementia worldwide by a truly multidisciplinary approach, from the social scientists down to, hopefully, eventually, the physicists. They're not really involved just now. One day they will be. So how does the environment shape the brain? Well, this is a football match, a World Cup final, 1994, between Brazil and Italy. And a group of scientists actually took some Brazilian and Italian fans, and they took saliva samples before and after the match. And they found that not only did the players show changes in their testosterone as a result of winning or losing, but so did the fans. So the Brazil fans showed an increase in testosterone, and the Italian fans showed a decrease in testosterone. Now, why is that important? And by the way, you women here also have testosterone in your bodies, a bit less than men, but it works in more or less the same way as it does with men. So winning here increases testosterone, and losing decreases it. Why is that important? Well, testosterone, as it increases another chemical messenger in the brain called dopamine. And dopamine is a critical neurotransmitter for making the frontal parts of our brain, the thinking, judging, planning, social interaction parts of our brain, it helps them upregulate. It also affects our mood. Increased dopamine activity makes us feel less depressed and more engaged. So here we have an environmental situation, winning a World Cup final, shaping the brains of millions of people. All the fans in Brazil with increased testosterone and all the fans in Italy with decreased testosterone, and thereby massive neurosurgery of millions of brains by one social experience. Now, let's just look at this dopamine, because whenever any of you get a pay rise, are paid a compliment, have a pint of Guinness, have sex, every time you have that, the good feeling that comes from that is because of increased dopamine activity in a part deep in your brain called the reward network. Now, here we have the reward network. This is PET imaging, looking at the activity in that same network that lights up when someone says, well, that's a, you know, you did a really good presentation today. Okay? That's what happens. That's why you feel good. So this is macaque monkeys. Now, macaque monkeys, like human beings, vary in terms of their dominance. You know, some of you are more bossy than others, okay? Well, it's the same in macaque monkeys. Some are more bossy and dominant than others. And if you house them individually, there's a wee bit of a difference in the activity in that network for the dominant and the submissive monkeys. But not a huge amount. Put them in together, look what happens. You squish out the reward network activity in the submissive ones and you boost it up in the bosses. There's an environment, a social environment, shaping the brain in its very fundamental, most fundamental way possible. What are the consequences of that? You feel more in charge, you feel more positive, your mood lifts, you're more aggressive, and you're smarter. You're smarter because your frontal lobes are functioning better. And the opposite here for the submissive monkeys. Now, here's the only study in humans looking at exactly that activity in that reward network in the brain by perceived social status, where you see yourself in the pecking order, the social pecking order. The higher you feel yourself to be in terms of social status, the more dopamine activity there is in the reward network of your brain. If that isn't the social environment shaping the biology, I don't know what is. And this has very important consequences for you, for all of us, for the whole notion of disability and particularly of dementia. Because feeling powerless, which happens if you're a non-boss with the bosses, reduces your mental function. Your ability to solve problems. In ordinary people like you, I break you into groups and I say, you in this side of the room, I want you to remember a time when you were powerless, when someone had power over you, giving you an appraisal, for instance, or deciding whether you got a job or not. I want you to bring into mind a time when you had power over someone. You will solve your problems less well. Your frontal lobes will be impaired by powerlessness. Okay? So, and aging disempowers us in ageist societies such as the one we live in. And our striatal dopamine goes down with age. That in turn affects our mental function, which of course further, and our confidence and our mood, and of course further depletes our ability to actually combat these negative stereotypes. Now, again, a horrible slide, but this is one of the most important findings in neuroscience, totally underreported, undercited. A wonderful scientist called Lars Nyberg in Sweden. What he did was, we all know that we get a bit less sharp with age. You know, we you know, if there's hard problems to solve or arithmetic, I tend to ask one of my I get lazy. I get my PhD student to do the hard problems. And that's because my working memory capacity to keep that capacity to hold things in mind and do calculations gets depleted with age, and everyone has shown that. And we usually show that by functional magnetic resonance imaging, where you put people into the brain scanners like we have over the road in Trinity, and you give them tasks to do, and you look at what parts of the brain are active. And what you find is, between old and young people, you'll find that there's differences in these areas here, frontal and parietal areas of the brain. There's different levels of activity there for the older people than the young. And we say, there's the evidence of the brains of older people declining, and that's why explains why they can't do the sums as well as the younger people. However, Lars Nyberg, what he did was, at the same time, he measured the activity in that reward network, in that dopamine area, okay, that goes down when you're with the bossy people, bossy monkeys. And he statistically took out that dopamine activity from the MRI data. And what he discovered was almost, not quite, but almost all the differences between old and young disappeared when you eliminated the differences in the dopamine activity. And remember, that dopamine activity is affected by social relationships, by environment, by your sense of empowerment. So that tells us that some of these cognitive changes in older people are secondary to social and differences in social networks, etc. So here we have, what are we going to do about dementia? Well, we have to have a multi-level approach. So at the molecular, we can't do anything at the quantum level. Pharmaceutical, the molecular and cellular. We can possibly influence systems in the brain by a number of methods, including non-invasive brain stimulation, tiny stimulation of the brain. This is very experimental. We can affect, even in people with dementia, we can affect cognitive performance with cognitive behavioral training, with environmental enrichment, and in the social level, with empowerment, advocacy, education, equality, precisely the things that the Genio programs are doing, we can also shape the biology of the brain. So we have to do it both ways. We have to have respect across levels of analysis, not of any one level of analysis dominating. We can't have people saying, the social level saying, dementia is a normal part of aging. And we can't have people at the molecular level saying, all this social worker nonsense, we will find the molecular clue. It's not going to happen. We need every single level there working together. So back to the fish. Why does Mr. NT turn into Mr. T? Well, the reason is this. Mr. T is called T because he has territory. Mr. NT has no territory in Lake Tanganyika. Mr. NT has the misfortune to be highly colored, which is good when it comes to his sex life, but bad when it comes to being eaten by a gull. So Mr. NT is swimming along, and suddenly he sees vacant territory because Mr. T has been plucked out. So Mr. NT goes into the territory, and merely by virtue of having territory is biologically transformed into a T-fish in every way: colouring, size, sex, aggression, dominance. If that isn't environment affecting someone, I can't think what is. But that's only fish, and it doesn't happen to humans, does it? Oscar winners live an average 4 years longer than Oscar nominees. And that is the increase in lifespan you would get if you cured all cancers. Nobel Prize winners live a year and a half longer on average than Nobel nominees. Environment, including the environments you all work in, are among the most profoundly shaping, treating, effective means of combating both at the prevention and the mitigation of dementia. Thank you very much.